Coming up.
How do scientists define happiness?
How do you feel, patient 957?
Oh, I feel like God's rubbing my tummy.
One of the challenges in thinking about happiness is whether you're thinking of it as this overall trait in life. Like, are you a happy person, or you're thinking of it as a specific emotional experience? Because I'm happy. Clap along if you know what happiness is to you. Because I'm happy.
Clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do. Wouldn't it be nice if there were a handy acronym that explained what happiness is?
OKRA, optimism, kindness, resilience, awareness. These are four pillars that make up your capacity for happiness.
Our guest is Emiliana Simon-Thomas from the Greater Good Science Center.
The science of happiness.
Your land is rich, your people happy. Who could be displeased with that?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
As Thanksgiving approaches, we want you to know that we're grateful to you, our listeners.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
All holding hands at midnight beneath a starry sky. Oh, there's nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. Stanford across the bay is where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years. Although I have now seen the light, and I teach at Berkeley.
Oh, you turncoat, you turncoats! Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the science of happiness.
Well, Ken, psychology used to be mainly concerned with unhappiness, treating people with trauma or pathology. But now there's this emerging science of positive psychology, which focuses on how ordinary people can cultivate positive life quality.
Yeah, you know, now talking about the science of happiness suggests that we can measure happiness, predict what will make people happy. But, you know, you can't measure happiness until you know what it is. So, and that's the job of philosophy. So tell me, John, what exactly is happiness?
Well, I must know, because when I was a kid, they'd say, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands, and I'd clap my hands. But it's a little like St. Augustine on time. What then is happiness? If no one asks me, I know exactly what it is. But when I want to explain it, I do not know.
So it's hard to define happiness, I grant you, but most people know whether or not they're happy. So let me ask you, John, would you say that you're happy?
Well, I can't complain about my career. It's gone pretty well. I've got a wonderful family.
You certainly do.
My days are filled with pleasurable experiences, like talking to you, Ken. I live in a beautiful part of the world. I get to read and teach and think about philosophy and get paid for it. On the other hand, you know, I think the world is going to hell in a handbasket. I'm a bit of a pessimist, and that can make me grumpy at times. So, I don't know. Am I happy or not?
Well, you know, your answer is a complex answer. Think about it. It suggests at least three different things that happiness might mean. I'm not sure what it does mean, but from your answer, it might mean something like this. You mentioned satisfaction. You talked about your career and family. And then you talked about these pleasurable experiences that you have. That's the more hedonistic interpretation of a happiness. And then you mentioned something about mood, being cheerful or grumpy, and your outlook on life, you know, being a pessimist or an optimist. So, I don't know, there's three different things going on there.
Well, I did my job. Now you tell me which of them it is. I mean, if we're talking about the science of happiness, we should have a nice, crisp definition. One of those things over the others, or maybe some precise combination of different factors.
I don't know. Let's take them in order and see what we get. I mean, consider life satisfaction. I mean, could you imagine a person who's satisfied with life but still unhappy? That seems kind of like a contradiction, right?
Well, I don't know. I think I can imagine such a person. I mean, think of someone who's kind of focused on making money and advancing their career, and they've done very well at that, so they're pretty satisfied. But while they've been busy accomplishing their goals, they never stop to smell the roses or read the philosophy or nurture relationships. So their success feels a little hollow.
Yeah, I get your drift, but is that kind of person really satisfied? Maybe they once thought they were, but their values changed. Maybe it was just an illusion, and, you know, that at some moment of reflection, that feeling of satisfaction just evaporated.
Well, let's move on. How about enjoying many pleasures in life? The second thing you mentioned, does that suffice for happiness?
Suffice? Well, maybe it suffices. I don't know, but it's certainly not necessary. I mean, I can easily imagine someone who suffers many hardships and few pleasures in life, but they still maintain one of those things you were talking about, a positive outlook through it all, and they might very well consider themselves happy.
Well, that leaves the third one, mood, being cheerful versus grumpy. Yeah, it doesn't seem quite right, because isn't there a difference between being in a good mood and being happy? I mean, moods are shifting, ephemeral, whereas happiness is more constant, isn't it?
I see what you mean, but happiness, too, is like that. I mean, there have been times in my life when I've been very, very happy, and times when not so much. So happiness comes and goes, too. It shifts. You know, that makes me think maybe happiness is more of what we like to call a dispositional state. It's not something that's in you at the moment, but it's a tendency to be in a good mood more of the time, or maybe most of the time, or a tendency to have a positive outlook. But you can have that tendency, but not at this moment be exercising that tendency.
Well, if that's what happiness is, I think it's overrated. I mean, who are the most annoying people in the world, aside from political candidates? cheerful and overly positive people. They annoy me a great deal, and they obviously only have a tenuous grip on reality.
John, that's just your grumpy inner grump speaking. You know, I love it. I know and love your grumpiness, but I don't know. But, you know, we haven't even mentioned Aristotle, what he called eudaimonia, meaning flourishing or well-being. He believed that human happiness was tied to human flourishing, and human flourishing had to do with virtuous activity, living a virtuous, reasonable life.
Well, Aristotle may have been onto something. Research suggests that much of our happiness depends on daily habits and activities. People are happier when they have meaningful connections with others and when they feel grateful. They've cultivated the attitude of gratitude in themselves.
Yeah, that's a good thought. You know, to follow up on that thought, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shukha Kalantari, to explore how things like gratitude and personal relationships are linked to our health and our happiness. She files this report.
In March 2013, San Diego resident Natalie Price had just lost her job. She was also out of shape, going through a nasty divorce, and she and her two kids had to move back into her parents' house. Price was not happy.
I was so stressed out. I remember going to bed that night, thinking tomorrow when I wake up, I'm going to be stressing all day about how I can't take care of what I need to take care of. And I woke up at about 2 a.m. with my arm and my hand hurting.
Price was having a heart attack. She recovered at the UC San Diego Medical Center. Today, she's a lot healthier and happier, and she says it's all because of gratitude. After her heart attack, Price took part in a UCSD study looking at how gratitude affects people with heart health problems. One of the things she did was write journal entries about what she was grateful for that day.
Honestly and truthfully, some days I would sit there and look at that piece of paper and say, like, I have nothing to be grateful for. I got this, I got that, and I don't have this.
But the exercise got Price thinking more about the things that make her happy, like playing music at her church or walking on the beach.
That study forced me to think about, well, yeah, that's wrong, that's bad, but this isn't that bad.
It's like strength training for the heart.
Meredith Pung co-authored the UCSD study. Her team looked at some 200 people who were at risk of heart failure, which happens when the heart isn't getting enough blood. People have had heart attacks, like Price, are at a high risk of developing it. And that's a bad thing, because half of those with heart failure die within 5 years of diagnosis. Pung says people who did gratitude journaling for 8 weeks were happier and showed signs of a healthier heart afterwards. Subjects who didn't do any gratitude journaling didn't have these additional moments of heart relaxation.
So the heart just needs a break, right? So with grateful contemplation, gratitude journaling, that allows for a little physiological break for the heart and allows it to continue its job for as long as we need it.
Study participants also reported fewer symptoms of depression, and they also slept better at night. Natalie Price says gratitude journaling got her back on her feet.
I joined the gym. It was enjoyable. I started doing more physical activities, and I became more cognizant of my health and what I ate. I still am.
But it's not just gratitude that links us to happiness. Research shows things like empathy, mindfulness, and our personal relationships also play a big role. Take the Harvard study of adult development. Starting in 1938, researchers have tracked the lives of two groups of men. The first group started the study as sophomores at Harvard College. The second group was very different. Here's psychiatrist Robert Waldinger, the director of the study, speaking at a TEDx conference in 2015.
The second group that we've followed was a group of boys from Boston's poorest neighborhoods. Boys who were chosen for the study specifically because they were from some of the most troubled and disadvantaged families in the Boston of the 1930s. Most lived in tenements, many without hot and cold running water.
The goal of the study was to identify predictors of healthy aging. Over the decades, these men were given questionnaires about their lives and did in-person interviews with the Harvard researchers. They were asked things like, where do you work? Do you like your job? Are you happy in your marriage? Researchers also gathered medical information about their mental and physical health.
The clearest message that we get from this 75-year study is this: good relationships keep us happier and healthier, period. People who are more socially connected to family, to friends, to community are happier, they're physically healthier, and they live longer than people who are less well connected.
The science is there, and the body of evidence continues to grow. Happiness is key to a long and healthy life. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka. I'm John Perry. I'm here along with my fellow philosopher from Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in beautiful Berkeley, California.
And our guest today is the science director at the Greater Good Science Center, also here at UC Berkeley. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Emiliana Simon Thomas.
Emiliana, you're a scientist by training. What got you interested specifically in research about happiness?
So I have this poignant childhood memory. I grew up in Berkeley. I was raised by two parents who were Irish Catholic in their upbringing, who moved to Berkeley before I was born and adopted a Buddhist philosophical spiritual path.
Oh my goodness.
And in this conversation, they were telling me that, you know, life was suffering. And I was arguing, no, life is fun. We should be happy. We should have dessert. And that really kind of shaped a need to understand this a little bit better.
So kind of a typical Berkeley family, Buddhist talking about life is suffering on the way to the beach.
Right? That's right. That's right.
So Ken and I were trying to figure out how to define happiness, and frankly, we didn't come to any very definitive conclusions. But as a scientist, you must have a precise, crisp definition that takes care of all problems. You want to share it?
I do. But you'll be perhaps not surprised to learn that even scientists don't have a consensus definition of happiness. We have a lot of different ways that we try to measure it. I'm going to give you the one that I like. And this is happiness as a blend of a couple of different things. And you guys alluded to this earlier, too. It's not just one thing. The blend, do you like okra? Fan of okra?
Yeah. Okay, okra, so, or okra?
The vegetable.
Oh, the vegetable, yeah.
Oh, okra.
Or is it a fruit?
Oh, yeah. It's a vegetable.
Okra, I say okra, optimism, kindness, resilience, and awareness, O-K-R-A. These are four pillars, four aspects of your life that make up your capacity for feeling happy day in and day out.
So why, I mean, okay, if we were to go out there and ask all those people if they're happy, they would give us an answer, yes or no. Would it track with your definition? I mean, is that like a scientific discovery? Is that just a stipulation? Does it correct our ordinary notions of happiness or what? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out.
I think it fleshes out a lot of our ordinary notions of happiness. And it comes from research where we, very much like the research that Shuka talked about, where we look at people in the world and we do kind of trust people's sort of feeling of what is happiness. We don't say, here's what happiness means, are you it? Yeah. We say, how happy are you? Because people kind of do know that. They're good at gauging their own happiness. But then we look at what's going on in their lives.
Yeah.
How connected are they? What was their childhood like? How much money do they have? And all those things.
So they might not really know. They know that they're happy, but they don't really have a well-worked-out theory of what it is that makes them. And then you, the scientist, comes along and says, aha, this is what's really going on when you say, I'm happy.
And one of the famous studies shows, this is Ed Diener's sort of pioneering study, shows that people who call themselves very happy, the only variable that consistently predicts that is social connection.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater. Our guest is Emiliana Simon-Thomas from the Greater Good Science Center. And we're thinking about the science of happiness.
How do we measure happiness? Are we born with a disposition to be happy? Or is it something we develop in life? Is there anything we can do to improve our happiness?
Happiness, well-being, and life's challenges, along with questions from what I hope is our very happy audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
It's all 'cause I'm in love.
Thanks to our musical guest, Tin Cup Serenade. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, our guest. Is Emiliana Simon-Thomas from the Greater Good Science Center here at UC Berkeley, and we're thinking together about the science of happiness.
How do you think about your own happiness? Do you know what things make you happy? Do you know how to measure it? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
So, Emiliana, so you're a scientist, and there's all this scientific research and this new thing, right? It's not just for philosophers and religion anymore. So tell me, what's the most surprising result that scientific research about happiness has revealed?
I think the most surprising result really has to do with how important our interpersonal connections are to happiness and how easy it is to develop these deliberately in our own lifetimes. So granted, there are some really early life experiences that are going to shape your capacity to connect and feel comfortable around others, but there are behaviors that we can engage in day in and day out that will make relationships with other people more successful, which then has the nice effect of making us
this
happier.
This sounds cool to me, but I was just asking you, what about people who live monastic type lives, you know?
Yeah,
celibate types lives.
How about all these Buddhas off in their caves? What would your folks say if you told them that they weren't happy?
Are they not capable of?
No. I mean, the irony is that a lot of this wisdom is drawn from the Buddhist sort of the ideas from Buddhism, which is compassion. And a lot of the spiritual practices of Buddhism are to really try to foster and cultivate and project compassion into the world for all sentient beings. That's even more than most of us can even really think about. But
it's one thing to have compassion for all sentient beings, but that doesn't actually put me into interpersonal relationship with them. I could just give money to a worthy cause. I could give until it hurts kind of thing, like, you know, extreme altruists sometimes do. But that's not like me and you in a relationship, a concrete... I mean, is it the compassion for people as abstracta, as it were, or is it the concrete particularity of concrete relationships?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. And I would venture to guess that most monastic lifestyles involve quite a bit of social interaction. You may go to the cave for 3 months or 3 years, but then you come back to the community that you're in, where you're surrounded by other people who do the very same thing as you day in and day out, who look very similar to you and share the same sort of philosophical principles and practices. So I think there's a whole lot of community there.
How about connections that aren't with other human beings, like dogs? I mean, I have a dog. I have a pretty good relationship with a dog. And there's also people that have relationships with beings. I wouldn't call them fictional, but like God and Jesus and so forth. And that seems to make them pretty happy. Is that the same phenomenon as we have with other human beings, just kind of a little out at the margins?
I would say yes. And I think that there is actually good evidence that pets are beneficial to happiness. That when people who don't have the same kind of family connections, mm-hmm. But do end up getting a pet, mm-hmm. if you bring pets into hospitals, patients do better. There is benefit to having any kind of interdependent relationship where you're lending support and something is providing support to you.
So I'm going to hazard a speculative guess. I think of people as intensely social. I think of us as evolved for sociality. So if I started thinking of a human animal as essentially a social creature evolved for a kind of sociality, then I think, well, it's not so surprising that your happiness is tied up with social interaction, because that's kind of what we're made for, is social interaction. We're not really made for the monastic life.
That's exactly how we think about it, and to back that up, we look at the body. We look at systems in the body that are there for making us feel motivated to affiliate, but on the same sort of vein, they also alleviate stress. So who knew that those were sort of opposite sides mm-hmm. of one coin? Becoming more pro-social, feeling more attuned to others in this empathic or compassionate space has, the fortuitous side effect of making you feel less stressed.
So stress, I want to focus on that. You say making you feel less stressed. Mm-hmm. I once attended a talk by a person who really impressed me. I can't remember. I think she was a psychologist or neuroscientist. She was
something.
A person.
They're all the same.
Yeah, somebody kind of in your world, right? Yeah. And she said, stress is good, uh-huh. right? That was the point of her talk. People are talking about avoiding stress, but stress is good. Because she said stress activates all these capacities in you. And many of these capacities are designed mm-hmm. as kind of stress coping mechanisms. And if you never exercise, I may be bastardizing what you said, but it was something along that lines. Is that?
I think you're absolutely right. And if we're going to use the evolutionary argument of sociality to support this idea that social activities make us happy, the evolution of our stress systems is also something that is good for survival. And we do need to feel aroused in certain circumstances where we're under threat or when somebody else is under threat. Imagine being totally non-stressed and seeing someone in pain. Maybe you just wouldn't do anything. You're kind of callous and apathetic. You need to have that stress response.
Hey, but common lore, self-help, says reduce your stress.
Well, there's a couple different kinds of stress. There's the stress in the moment where there's something really there that's threatening you or someone else. And then there's the stress that's imagined and that has to do with some hypothetical threat, right? Mm. Or perhaps some worry about your reputation or some deadline. Though that kind of stressing, which is kind of enduring and sustained, is harmful to your health and well-being. The stress that's reactive to an actual threat is really important. And then the other thing that's really important is being able to get through it quickly, not letting that stress kind of go on and on and on. You got a parking ticket, you can be angry. Okay, then you're okay 15 minutes later, you're not angry for the next 4 hours.
So I want to ask you about the K in okra, kindness.
Yes.
I just wonder, is this kind of like scientists giving us a persuasive definition? If you want to be happy, you ought to be kind, because they think it'd be good to have a lot more kind people around. But take Hannibal Lecter. He's fictional, yeah. And he's certainly not very kind, mm-hmm. but he's represented as being pretty happy. Is that because he's a psychotic, or is...
Yes. We would put him into the class of outlier.
Outlier, okay.
And outliers are hard to factor into a general pattern of how people behave. Why we think that kindness is good for happiness is because when we look at the brain, when people are given the opportunity to be generous or to cooperate, people's brains are reflective of a greater sort of pleasure response. Okay. So when you are kind, we think, oh, we're going to get it for ourselves. That's going to make us happy. But actually, we're happier when we cooperate and give.
But there's something beneath John's question. There's a that I wonder what I mean, some people think, well, different things make different people happy. Mm-hmm. Torturing ducks may make a cruel person happy, mm-hmm. right? We don't approve of the happiness of the cruel person because happiness as such is kind of morally neutral, right? But your okra thing doesn't sound so morally neutral. It sounds because kindness and all that, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, does the science of happiness about a morally neutral notion of happiness such that, you know, Hitler may have been very happy, but he was lots and lots of bad things, right? So the fact that he was happy neither recommends his life nor disrecommends his life, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the challenge for me in all of these hypothetical questions is, are those people actually happy? Mm. Is the duck torturer actually happy? We don't know that. If they're smiling, that's one way to imagine, well, maybe they're happy because they smile a lot, but did we ask them, are you happy? What's going on in their lives? You know, it's hard to really, to justify their life as one that is happy if I actually don't know if they're really happy.
It's hard to justify their lives to the rest of us. But if that's their guiding passion and they get lots of jollies out of it, they may look forward to the day when they get, oh God, I got a really cool duck to torture now. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I would ask someone to run a longitudinal study of Dutch torturing and see if it... duck torturers, sorry. Yeah. Dutch?
You are a scientist.
I haven't done it. Yeah. I'll go back tomorrow.
Yeah, the subjects committee
wouldn't recruiting let you do duck that. Torturers for an interesting study on happiness.
Let me just ask one quick question before we go to our questions. The A in okra, awareness. Now, there is a stereotype that a lot of people are happy because they're blissfully unaware. So is this, what kind of awareness are you talking about? It seems to me if you're really aware of what a crummy, how many people are suffering in the world and what happened to our democracy, it'd make you pretty unhappy.
And I used to, when I was an adolescent, just to add on this, I wanted to be an artist. I thought if you're to be an artist, you have to be tortured. Happiness is for the uncreative, the unengaged, the blind and the blithe. And happiness is a bourgeoisie thing and all that. I thought that when I was a young guy.
So that attention awareness piece comes from a couple places. The first place is, again, the kind of monastic traditions and this idea that being more mindful, being more attuned to the present moment that you're in is actually associated with happiness or subjective well-being. The second piece is my good friend Matt Killingsworth's work using a little app, a smartphone app called Track Your Happiness. What it does is it pings people all day long throughout the day. What are you doing? Are you thinking about what you're doing? Are you thinking about something else? Are you thinking about something else better or something else worse? And what he finds, regardless of what people are doing, whether it's the dishes, making love, whatever it is, when they're thinking about that activity, not mind wandering into the past or the future, they're doing better. They're getting more out of that moment. They're feeling more happiness.
I think what you'd find is that no matter what they're doing, the ping annoys them.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the science of happiness in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater. And we've got questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name's Mike. I'm from Albany, California. And my question has to do with what role memory plays with happiness. Like one of the things that makes me happy now is when I don't experience secondhand smoke. But people smoked around me all the time when I was a child and growing up. And I'm unhappy when I smell it now. I don't know if that's trivial kind of happiness, but I know that how we remember things and how we think we're going to remember something has something to do with
it. Yeah, I mean, memory is sort of agnostic to happiness. It doesn't really decide. Your biology doesn't try to make you happy and remember happy things or not happy. What it does is it records what's happened in your life and what happens repeatedly, and it builds associations, and what happens together happens more easily. And so if you're interested in sort of cultivating more happiness, it would behoove you to do things day in and day out that repeat positive experiences in whatever context you're in. So maybe it's a gratitude practice. For you in the secondhand smoke experience, or I can only imagine that thinking about secondhand smoke could be unpleasant, but if you get through it quickly and you realize that now you don't have it, isn't that wonderful? Aren't you grateful for that? Maybe your experience is different.
So our colleague Laura Carstensen at Stanford studies aging, and one of the things she's studying is aging and happiness, and one of the other things she's studying in that regard is aging and memory. Mm-hmm. And I seem to recall from her that as we get older, our memories are of more pleasant things. Mm-hmm. And then when we're younger, our memories are of, we remember the less pleasant things more. We're more inclined to remember the less pleasant, or something like that. Does that sound like a...
She's probably got more expertise than I in that space, but I do think our memory at some level is sort of, what we can retrieve from memory is limited. What we can put into memory is unlimited. Mm-hmm. As we get older, that like little window probably gets narrower. And we do, as we get older, tend to become more generative. And, right. And that involves sort of thinking back on in a rosy way on the past.
That's kind of some results from her work. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Hi, my name is Valerie. I'm from Martinez, California. John brought up a question earlier about how do you measure happiness. So I was curious, in your OKRA definition of happiness, optimism, kindness, resilience, and awareness, is each component equally weighted, or do one or two components carry a greater sense of weight in terms of measuring someone's overall experience of happiness?
We're not there yet in terms of tailoring to a particular person. There are researchers who are trying to figure out, coming in, what is it that would be most beneficial to you in terms of your cultivation of happiness? Those principles come out of a combination of looking at people's brains when they're presented with sort of happy or unhappy sort of stimuli. They're also asking people just subjectively, are you a happy person? Do you consider yourself very happy? And also doing things like looking at people's faces when they are presented with something that is pleasurable. You know, do they smile at all? Do they smile really big and smile for a long time? Do they smile and then stop really quickly? All of these things inform this notion or this sort of combined palette of happiness.
So because of the combined palette, there's lots of room for variation, mm-hmm. lots of variables that might affect this. I wonder about things like cross-cultural regularities or
right.
cross-gender regularities or cross-racial. I mean, how much does this stuff vary with the way that human beings vary, you know?
There's a huge opportunity there research-wise. And for instance, gratitude in cultures that are much more collectivist. You know, we here live in a very individualistic culture and tend to focus on success and personal status and things like that.
You're not talking about Berkeley. You're talking about the United
That's
States.
That's right.
This is an outlier.
That's right. So in the collectivist cultures, when they did a gratitude journal, there was less of an impact on well-being because there was a ceiling effect. There already was this held sort of importance of interpersonal connections and interdependence. So
what about, okay, so that's cross-cultural variation, but what about gender? I mean, some people like to think of, John thinks all the world's problems are caused by men because all we're good at is, well, we're not good at much, right? And we cause most problems, especially if you think about sociality, you know, some people think women are more develop for the sociality, and the men are the hunters, and the this and the that. And I mean, what about cross-gender comparisons and
also,
the capacity for happiness?
You know, also an open field, and we don't have solid answers about who's better at what. Certainly, we know that there are hormones and certain neuropeptides that function uniquely in men and women's bodies. I mean, oxytocin, for example. We talk a lot about how important oxytocin is to social connection, but in women, it's also for breastfeeding and uterine contractions. It's not happening in men, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't play at the level of the brain, above the neck, that it doesn't play a very similar role in our sense of trust and safety and a sort of affiliative security.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the science of happiness with Emiliana Simon Thomas from the Greater Good Science Center.
Is happiness all it's cracked up to be? I mean, what's wrong with being sad sometimes? Aren't happy people, for the most part, just deluded?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California. We'll take more questions from our audience, our highly happy audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
When you jump up to heaven and you meet old St. Pete, tell that boy jump for joy. Just jump right in, get Pete some skin and jump for joy.
Thanks to our live musical guest, Tin Cup Serenade. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about the science of happiness with Emiliana Simon-Thomas from the Greater Good Science Center. And we've got a question from our audience. So welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I'm Benjamin, and I'm from Berkeley, California. Sometimes when I'm happy, I do things that make me feel guilty and then unhappy. So what should I do to return to those, to that state of happiness, and what do you think the cause might be?
So aging about 40 years will help a lot.
I guess I would ask you, what is it that you're doing? Not because I want you to answer that question, but I think that if you wanted to look at a list of research-tested things that you could do that probably wouldn't leave you feeling guilty, they're out there, and those would be things like just being kind to someone else. If you're feeling happy, go out and start up a conversation with another person, or when you're walking down the street and you see somebody who is having trouble getting their groceries into the car, say, hey, can I help you? Or somebody who's looking lost, looking at their mobile device, hey, do you need some help finding where you're trying to go? So there's a whole science on how random acts of kindness, and this is not just Berkeley, random acts of kindness enhances people's happiness.
But there's a question underlying that interesting to me. I mean, nobody does well all the time. Nobody is kind all the time. Nobody's aware all the time. If you thought of happiness as episodic states, then when you're not having those good feelings, those positive, you're not happy. But you don't think of it that way. Mm-hmm. You think of it as much more kind of dispositional, mm-hmm. right? So how does the moments of non-kindness, non-awareness, non-engagement, I mean, how does that fit into your...
That's when we need help. That's why we express things like sadness. That's why we express and feel things like guilt. Guilt isn't something that holds us away into a corner. Guilt is an expression of, hey, I've transgressed a social norm here, and I feel badly about it, and I am actually feeling something that's driving me to reconcile.
Right, but that doesn't seem like a component of... So the moments when I'm like disappointed, sad, beating up on myself... Okay, I have this standing disposition not to do that, but mm-hmm. today I'm overcome with it. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense to say, well, you're happy today. Seems like I'm unhappy today.
Well, but this is the reason why you would focus on having your strong social connections, because hopefully in those moments when you're expressing sadness, there's someone around. And the reason you express sadness is precisely because it makes somebody else who cares about you approach you and comfort you. And how do you feel then? How do you feel when that person comes, puts their arms around you and says, hey, it's all right. Everything's going to be fine.
So that suggests that this responsiveness, guilt, sadness, especially if they're communicated and expressed, mm-hmm. are part of my overall equipment or tools uh-huh. for managing my life happy.
That's right. And well, in the context of your social relationships. Right. We did this great study looking at how often people from all over the world used little emoticons on Facebook. And so we told Facebook, look, you know, just the smile and the frown, not interesting enough. You got to put in different kinds of smiles, an amusement, an enthusiasm, a smile. Anyway, what we found was a little bit of a surprise. The countries where people used the whole range, the whole palette from positive to negative in a kind of regular fashion rather than a whole bunch at once and then none for 5 days or all positive and never negative, the ones that were diverse, like we call it emoversity, the ones that were diverse were associated with the greatest benefits to those countries' well-being as measured by other national measures.
You're telling us emoticons are a good thing.
I think if you have no other option for face-to-face communication, sharing your emotions virtually is certainly a good thing, and including the negative ones is important.
Sometimes I think I really am a grouch.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I'm Charlie from Palo Alto, California.
Thanks for making the trek up.
Well, Berkeley and Palo Alto.
Burst my bubble. I was so happy.
Well, what I've noticed is when I'm happiest is when I'm not thinking about when I'm happy. And if I start analyzing it, I become unhappy. So I guess my question is, why? Is there some empirical reason to study happiness? Is it for fun? Why do it?
And that seems to give the lie to your A part of okra.
That's right, the attention awareness. That thinking about why you're happy, analyzing it, imagining what it is that makes you happy, when you're doing that, you're not in the moment attending to what's around you and what's happening in that moment within you, right? You're thinking about other things. You're in a sense, you're mind wandering about the sources of happiness, and that is chipping away at your capacity to be happy in that moment.
So there's a Chinese thing from the Tao Te Ching that says something like this, you know, the good swimmer forgets the water. Because as soon as he thinks about the water, he's like, what's my relationship to the water, right? And he the good swimmer is just in there doing. Now, it's competent doing, it's engaged doing, because they do the right thing, they make the right stroke. But it's not thinking about the water. So when you say in the moment, that doesn't mean thinking about what makes me happy and whether I'm happy. That's doing the thing, right?
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. That's exactly right.
You're sounding a little like Heidegger, I'll warn you.
I know. Well, Heidegger sounds a little bit like Lao Tzu, or Chuang Tzu. That's from Chuang Tzu. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hello, I'm Jennifer, and I'm very happy to be here today from football-crazed San Francisco. My question is, can you expand on the connection between nature and nurture and happiness? And as an aside, there was some thought that you can actually make up your mind to be happy. And I have a friend who actually changed her name to Happy. She really is happy, and she doesn't want to hear any negative talk. I can't even complain about Muni, and it drives me crazy.
So we do know that people are born with certain genetic kind of profiles, and that genetic profile has an effect on how easy it might be for you to experience positive states, or how easy it will be to recover from negative states. That's about 50% of the variance between you and your friend who you described in terms of where you might place on a happiness scale. But that leaves a lot of room, right? That leaves a lot of room for deliberate day in and day out intentional behaviors. Now, if you had the option to advise your friend, I would encourage her not to try to suppress or dismiss or omit negative experiences from her life. Difficulties happen. People lose stuff. People die. We suffer, and that is part of life. So my parents were a little bit right, but but we have the tools to manage it, and one of those tools is our community and our friends, and it's good for you to be there for her, and it's good for her for you to have you there for her.
So you said 50% of the variance is genetic.
Mm-hmm.
That leaves 50 more percent.
Yeah.
Somebody might think the other 50% is like upbringing or something like that. But that's not right, is it?
You might think that, but the analysis that I'm referring to found that only 10% of the variance was due to context. So privilege, upbringing, where you are in the sibling order, whether you're male or female.
50% is genetic, 10% is
context.
Yep. What's that leaves 40%? Where's that other?
That's what we're doing every day. That's what we're feeding our nervous system. So are we feeding our nervous system a habit of pessimistic, you know, doomsday thinking and and you know, conflict?
or
something else.
That made me think, because I knew you were going there.
Yeah.
But that made me think back to her friend who decided to be happy.
Uh-huh.
Who said, I don't want to hear your complaints about the Muni. Yep. Right? I mean, maybe she's doing the right thing, right?
There, it could be like a launching pad, right? If you just want to get started and you want to go whole hog for, you know, 10 days and then kind of ease out and make something that's a little more balanced, that might work for people.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask you one last question. We're near the end, but, you know, we're in the political season. And in this particular political season, anger seems to be highly prevalent. People are angry at the billionaire class, they're angry at the politician. Trump and Sanders both have tapped into a deep well of anger. Mm-hmm. Sounds like happy people should like not be so prone to anger. They should like contain their anger, not let it get in the way. What do you say to a populace that is gripped with anger at all these unfair forces and dark, you know?
Well, I think anger is essential to humanity as a response to injustice. We need anger to manage our social collectives, to motivate us to change things that are unfair in places where hierarchy can be a service but also a disservice. But your question seemed to be about kind of runaway anger.
Yeah, right.
And anger that isn't really productive, anger that's not motivating a response or a solution to the problem. I would argue that people who are happy, who have the disposition for happiness, use their anger wisely. It's not just to foment more kind of discord in the world, but it's to figure out how to solve the problem and do something about
it. So some of us kind of get angry at Hillary because she's not angry enough. Sounds like you think that's misguided.
Could be.
Well, Emiliana, this has been a really fascinating conversation. You're a great communicator. This is great work. I could talk to you for hours, but I have to say goodbye to you now. So I'm going to thank you for joining.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such fun. Thank you.
Our guest has been Emiliana Simon-Thomas, science director at the Greater Good Science Center here at UC Berkeley. So, John, what happiness-making thoughts are you thinking now?
Usual, not many. our guest was wonderful. She seemed quite knowledgeable at happiness, and she also seemed pretty happy. So that kind of confirms confirms the science.
A grouch who studies happiness.
Yes,
that would be interesting.
Maybe we'll found a center for the, you know, grouchiness studies, a center. What was it? Got a dismal science center at Berkeley.
Well, I mean, I think this is a fascinating topic, and I think it's a great coming together of common sense, philosophy, science. There's a lot of stuff there. It's a rich, rich thing. In the old days, psychology used to be concerned with not just dysfunction, but also happiness and also extraordinary capacities. And then the behaviors came along, and that all went away, and now psychology is getting back to its roots. Anyway, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. Now, you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, what makes this next man happy? Talking fast. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the internet is full of alarming stories about things you thought were good for you, but aren't. I just came across one from the UK Guardian warning me about mindfulness, the state of mind or lack of a state of mind that on a deep level is an inner peace generator and on a shallow level keeps you from bumping into the wall. Well, mindfulness has its dangers. Some go so deep into meditation the mind wanders. Then childhood traumas, long thought forgotten resurface leading to alcohol abuse, old school therapy, and an alarming increase in articles in the UK Guardian. The Guardian cites a UC Irvine study from 1992, which found that 63% of a group studied, quote, had suffered at least one negative effect from meditation retreats, unquote, whatever that means. Maybe they bumped into the wall. And 7%, quote, reported profoundly adverse effects, including panic, depression, pain, and anxiety, unquote. A more recent 2011 Duke University study raised concerns, as they say, about the lack of quality research on the impact of mindfulness. So maybe mindfulness is not the path to happiness. Many happiness paths have proven false. In recent years, many ways to mental health have been found and lost through introspection, the forking paths of inner peace and denial. Heroin can make you happy unless you run out of it or overdose. I just read a stupid internet article about a hot new trend, conversational commerce. We already have this. It's working through voicemails to pay a bill or buy a ticket, talking to a bot on the phone, texting. Conversational commerce is what we had before with a different name now, which always makes us happy. Like when taxi became Uber. Supposedly, these commercial interactions will just keep getting better until we won't know the difference between a robot and a clerk. Well, one happiness indicator is social interaction, and buying stuff makes us happy. So if the app selling us stuff is like a puppy or a wistful girlfriend, well, I guess it's a win-win. Unfortunately, it goes the other way as well. Hell is other people. They can harsh or mellow, kill your buzz, rain on your parade. But if the idea is to make a perfect bot that will never let you down, I still don't know. The internet is there not so much to please us, but to get our attention. And it does this often by offering us disruptions of what we thought we knew. The internet brings us bizarre news. Mindfulness could be banned for you. Things that could go wrong, but are still cute. Kittens stuck in jars. Top 10 ways your head could explode. Top scientists say you're wasting your life. Learn more. Could the South Pole be the next Brooklyn? Something is wrong, and only the internet knows what it is. And if it's true that artificial intelligence may turn the corner into a weird self-consciousness, well, what will the internet want? If the past is any indicator, the only thing that will make the internet happy is our attention, our continued mild unhappiness, our eternal discontent. A click here to find out more. Check out these insanely mind-blowing facts. 7 ways the world might end. Happy now? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Nicole Pena, Mo Mukin, Dan Brandon, Dominic Borg, and Crystal Nickerson.
Thanks also to our musical guests, Rolf Wilkinson, Safa Chokrai, and Larry Wright, Tin Cup Serenade.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Ba 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 bimbo.